Oh, the first question for this evening is not a question but an essay. Please try and keep them short. But anyway, here we go. About noble silence. Sometimes it is necessary for the ladies of my suite to communicate. I try to communicate in silence. One lady just says it aloud. She also makes unnecessary comments such as, I like this brand of tea, not that brand of tea. Another lady responds, oh, you don't like that brand. Please explain how silence supports people on this retreat. Now, the most important silence is not the silence with the mouth, but the silence between your ears. So another person makes a lot of noise, and it does not echo in your brain. So someone says, I like this brand of tea. And then you start thinking, what are they saying that for? They shouldn't say that. They're supposed to be quiet. They're disturbing my meditation. This is really bad. You've made much more noise than they have. So remember, it's the echoes in your brain. That's the most important. So other people, that's their karma. What they do is is up to them. But your job is you be silent. Don't worry about anybody else. Otherwise, you'll start complaining about the birds not keeping noble silence. You've got to be quiet, bird. You shouldn't be making any noise on noble silence. So people will talk sometimes, but that's their problem. Don't you respond. So noble silence is a choice. But of all the noble silences, the noble silence between your ears is the most powerful. And how silence supports people on the street, you don't have to talk so much. I mean, why do you want to say, I like this brand of tea, not that brand? Come on, what's that got to do with the greater meaning of life? So, if you like this brand of tea or not that brand of tea, just take it or don't take it. So that way, you don't have to speak. But I tell you, I've already warned you, if that's really causing you a problem, please see Dania. She has the masking tape. And we can put that around their mouths. Oh, I don't like this type of tree. I don't like that type of tree. And they won't be able to say anything. Anyway, today I put my finger onto my lips to remind this lady about being silent. Bad advice, Ajahn. The way she glared at me in response. Destroyed my precious new inner stillness. Like a rock tossed into a still forest pool. The monks receive corrections more graciously than lay people. Is the difference between monks and laity? Thank you. Try it out. Try and correct the monks and the bhikkhunis too. Naughty bhikkhuni, naughty bhikkhuni. You see, she laughs. That's how we take criticism. So when they sort of glare at you, just burst out laughing. So no, but be careful. Please be sensitive to other people. So and if they put their fingers up, you know, I'm disturbing them. So be quiet. That's much, much better. So try and out of compassion for all other beings. And if you really, really, really do need to speak, if you really want a conversation with someone, borrow Dania's rabbit. And you can talk to the rabbit. And the rabbit will listen to everything you say and won't answer back. And if you put your fingers to the mouth of the rabbit will not change its countenance, just like a good monk and a good nun. Next question, what does sadhu mean? I don't know. Yes, I do. It means it is wonderful, it is awesome, it means cool. That's what it does. So if you don't like being sadhu, it is this cool, awesome, incredible, instead of sadhu. Are the stories in the great disciples of the Buddha, true. Who knows? But who cares? They're great stories. And never allow the truth to stand in the way of a good story. They're inspiring. So go for it. So what's one of your favorite stories of the great disciples? Okay, this is I love telling this story once every year on the retreat. Because you've got the stories of the great disciples, these arahats do amazing things. But what about the stories of the stupid disciples? And you can read those, because that's in the Vinaya. Because in the Vinaya, the rules of discipline for the monks and the nuns, those rules came about because some monk or some nun misbehaved. And when they misbehaved, people complained, they told the Buddha, so he laid down a rule. So, you know, it's inspiring to read the, you know, the stories of the great monks, but it's great, also good fun, to read the stories of the stupid monks and the stupid bhikkhunis as well. And this is the story I love to tell. You know this one. You know it's what's coming. It's a great story. So, this was at Sawati. There, you know, that's where King Pasadena lived, right close to the Jeta Grove. And it was the job of one of the bhikkhunis to empty the toilets every morning. So in those days, there was not like a sewage system. So everything would go into a big bucket, and they'd have to sort of take the bucket to another proper place, you know, where it would compost or something. But this one day, this bhikkhuni, early in the morning, cleaning out the toilets, decided it's too lazy to walk all over to where she's supposed to dispose of it. So instead, she threw the bucket of shit over the monastery wall. And you all know Murphy's Law. That works in India 25 centuries as much as it does in Perth, you know, this today. A guy was walking on the other side of the wall. Yeah, that's right. You can imagine it. Now, he was dressed up in his best clothes. He was going to the palace to see the king. Now, imagine you were going to an audience with Queen Elizabeth. And as you were walking down, you've got a bucket of shit over your head. How would you feel? He was very upset. He was annoyed because he knew who lived on the other side of the wall. Those nuns. He said, they're not real nuns. They're sort of stupid idiots. They're just prostitutes. They're not real nuns. I'm going to teach them a lesson. Look what they've done to me. They've put all this stuff over my best clothes. I was just about to see the king, and look what they've done to me. And he was so upset that he got one of the torches which they used to light the street. And he decided to burn down the whole monastery. Because it was all made of wood in those days. And he went there wanting to burn down the whole monastery. But that monastery had a gatekeeper, this very smart guy. And he said, what are you doing? I'm going to burn down this stupid monastery. Look what they've done to me. He said, you've got a bucket of that over your head? That's auspicious. That's like being blessed with holy water, only better. Now, haven't you heard the word before, holy shit? That's come from holy nuns. Now, it's amazing. And sometimes even I, and I'm sure the bhikkhunis over here know this, how gullible some of you are. And this guy said, really? That's auspicious? That's good luck? He said, yes, yeah, good luck. Excellent luck. Something wonderful would happen to you today. He said, really? Yeah. So go home and get changed. Go back to the palace. You'll have some good fortune. And so the guy believed it. I mean, that gatekeeper, you know, he could sell sort of ice to Eskimos, as they say. And he went back, he got changed, he went back to the palace again. And actually he was lucky. He did get this really lucrative contract from the king. And he spread it around to people saying, wow, you know, you are so fortunate. You know, if you really want to make a lot of money, go to the nuns' monastery and ask for some real holy blessings. And of course, people started spreading it around. That's the most incredible holy stuff from the nuns. And the Buddha heard about it. And so he sort of told the nuns, he said, look, you were very, very lucky that time. You had a very, very smart gatekeeper who managed to talk this guy out of burning your monastery. But don't do it again. And then one of the 311 rules for the bhikkhunis, one of the pratityas, is thou shalt not throw a bucket of shit over the monastery wall. That's one of the pratityas, isn't it? Yes, there you go, she's nodding. And that's where the story came from. Now those are the stories which are inspiring. And I think, because of the nature of that story, it probably did happen. I think that's true. You see, that these days, I mean, this I was there in Thailand once, and Ajahn Chah, he doesn't do holy water, but this general in the army came and asked for some holy water from Ajahn Chah. Now, he's not like generals in the army here in Australia. Those generals in Asia, they have immense power. You know, they can actually take you away in the middle of the night and just you disappear, even in Thailand. Remember, because I think at that time it was a military ruler who was running Thailand. No, they didn't have much democracy. So those generals were really powerful. And this general came up to Ajahn Chah and said, "No, can you please give me some holy water?" And Ajahn Chah usually doesn't do this, but this was a general, a very powerful one. So he said, "Come here." And so he came and sat in front of Ajahn Chah and said, "Bow your head." And he spat in the general's hair and then rubbed it in. Now, I was there and I thought, you've gone too far this time. You can't do that to a general in the army. But just like that stupid guy who got the bucket of shit over his head, this general, he loved every minute of it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm so lucky. I really got the best holy water straight from the mouth of Ajahn Chah. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And Ajahn Chah got away with it. Incredible. So my holy water story now. I told Ajahn Chah's one at the time of the bhikkhunis. In Thailand, in that monastery where I stayed, you had to stay up every week, not going to sleep, meditate all night. It was really tough. You know, 24 hours without sleep. And so you'd be meditating, and you get sleepy, but sometimes you get some good meditation as well. So after the dawn came up, you know, then you know, I left the hall and went to urinate. Now, there's two things to know. First of all, you know, it was the first light of day, so it wasn't all that clear. And number two, I'd been meditating all night, so my mindfulness wasn't that strong. And, you know, over in the jungle, you just, you know, squat down, you know, Asian style, and urinate in the forest. That's what I did. I squatted down and started urinating, you know, in the first light of day. And I really did think I was urinating on a stick. And then the stick started to move. I was peeing on a snake. Now, that was very, very dangerous, because that was a venomous snake. And the most sensitive part of the male body was only about 3 inches from that snake's mouth. You girls won't appreciate that, but that makes many of the guys here squirm. And did that snake bite me? No, it loved every minute of it. Why? Because I'm sure that that snake thought it was being blessed with holy water from a monk. So that's the time I peed on a snake, or blessed the snake, depending on which way you look at it. So those things happen. So those are like real stories, because they really happen. And yeah, you can believe them, because they're the sorts of things which would happen. So be careful. That's one of the reasons I say be careful of superstition. Because otherwise you come here and you ask for some holy water, and Bhikkhuni Sudama will say, "Bend your head over." Anyway, enough about that. What is the best way to be with strong samadhi and intense sensation in the head? Okay, now what's happening there, I said this to a few people, is when you've got the stillness of the mind, you start getting energy coming up, make sure you've already lost the awareness of the body. So all the attention is just on the sixth sense, the mind. Because if you get the strong samadhi and you've still got body awareness, that energy just goes into the body, and it's, you know, it can be interesting, but it's not really meant to go there, and it's really unpleasant. You know, too much energy going into your body. So if you follow the instructions, you know, you just present moment awareness and silence, then you start watching something like the breath. And you watch the breath to the exclusion of everything else, so the rest of the body disappears. So by the time you get to the delightful breath, you can't feel your feet. You can't feel your hands. You can't even feel your head. As I said, I think last night, mosquitoes could be biting you, the fly could be crawling on you. You can't feel it because you're focused inside. In the same way, when you're watching the television, you can't see the photo on the top of the TV set or the magazines underneath because you're just focused on the center and everything else falls off the screen. And that's what's supposed to happen. The body disappears. So all you've got left is the breath, which is part of your body, but that's the only thing left.
If you focus on the tip of the nose or on your belly, it's very hard to do. That's why it really helps not to focus anywhere, but just another sensation, because that means the body is disappearing quickly. But when that breath disappears, there's no way that the mind can link to the body anymore. You separated that link. So when you get energy, it stays in the mind where it's supposed to be. It doesn't go into the body. It doesn't cause that sort of intense sensation in the head or anywhere else. So see if you can actually go back to delightful breath, stay with the delightful breath, so you can't feel the body anymore. So someone can tap you on the head and you don't know it. And that shouldn't be that hard to do. And if you follow that instructions, then when you get into nice meditation, you can't feel any head. There's no sensation there at all. It's gone. And all the energy stays in the mind. And that's where beautiful nimittas come from. So, how to observe the strong sensation around the head during sleep time? When it's time to sleep, you sleep. So if you've already built up a lot of energy in there, sometimes it's hard to fall asleep. So again, the real mistake was just haven't really disconnected the mind from the body at that particular stage. And so you get energy in the body. And it's a bit tight. So really what you have to do, if you've got the strong sensation around the head when it's time to go to sleep, do a lot of loving kindness meditation. Relax to the max. Don't try and attain anything, just to ease all that energy and tension so it can disappear. My boss is victimizing me. I am depressed and don't want to go to work. Was that by one of the monks? Is that me? Because I'm their boss. Or is it your boss? Who's the boss at Dhammasala now? You. Ah. My boss has a grudge against me and I'm very miserable and my health is getting worse. What should I do? Yeah, just leave and become a monk or a nun. That's very good. Okay, now this is really common, seriously. The boss is victimizing you. And I don't know why this is, these days, because it's obviously bad for business. And it's all, the egos, they don't like someone, they want to put their own people in there, and people actually change. And they're victimizing. Obviously the best thing to do is to go to the boss above him, and complain, if that's at all possible. Because you find if they're victimizing you, they victimize other people. Probably many people in the department have left before you. Because, it's the character, it's nothing to do with you, it's to do with them. And by sort of going to the big boss above them, you're saying, I'm not doing this just for me, this is for the company. There's just too many good people are leaving because this person doesn't know how to manage. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So because of that, they usually hopefully can get rid of that boss. But if they can't, see if you can actually even look for other work, because it's very unpleasant. It's not just about money, it's about just the happiness and the fulfillment you have at work. That's why I always say, if you're offered promotions, don't take them, because more promotions means more stress, and don't think the extra money will come in handy, because the more money you have, the more money you don't have. In other words, it's never enough. So have a little bit of money, which is never enough, and a lot of money, which is never enough, because it's never enough anyway. And then you have less stress in life. And that's the problem. The higher you get up, so the tree, just the more these stupid bosses are up the top there. So if you're very miserable and your health is getting worse, what's more important? Your health and your happiness. So start searching around, see if there's any other work around. Yeah, you may sort of take a cut in salary, but you'd be happier and healthier. And if you do leave and you can't get a job at all, great! At last, you can become a monk or a nun. You're free! So that's the thing to do. So sometimes I might have said before, oh, just give loving kindness towards your boss. But usually by this stage, it's gone too far. It's very difficult to do. To sort of turn the boss around, that takes a lot of work and a lot of time. It can be done. Alternatively, you can ask the boss to come to a retreat. So here's a one-way ticket, boss. Sometimes that works, There was this one of the men from here. He was a Sri Lankan guy. And he was what we call a Waisak Buddhist. A Waisak Buddhist is one of these people who say they're Buddhist, but they only go to the temple once a year. A Waisak, and there's a lot of them around. This was a Sri Lankan Wesak Buddhist. And he told me he started to come every week. And I said, what are you coming every week for now? You only used to see you once a year. And he said, well, what happened was he had this Australian boss in his government department. And he said it was a boss from hell, you know, just always giving him more work than anyone could do. He'd try hard to complete the work and the boss would always say it's not good enough. Would never show any gratitude, always shouting. You know, you may know those bosses from hell. So he had a boss from hell. But in the space of about 3 months, his boss totally changed his character and became a very sensitive and like kind boss. You know, is this okay? Am I giving you too much? That was really good work. I really appreciate, you know, what you've done. Started being kind and showing appreciation. And this Sri Lankan guy, he couldn't help but ask, excuse me, boss, but you know that before you were very difficult to work with, but now you've changed. And actually now I can do war work for you, you know, with that side of attitude. What's happened? What have you done? And this boss, this Australian guy, said, well, you know, I found this wonderful Buddhist temple. You know, I've been doing meditation and listening to these talks on a Friday night at Nolamara, just round the corner. And this, that's, you know, that's our temple. And the Sri Lankan, that's my temple! But he'd never gone there, only on Wesak. And once he'd actually seen how it turned his boss around in 3 months, he started coming every week. Because it does work sometimes. So if you could, if this comes, I don't think it's actually from anyone who lives in Perth, but if it did come from Perth, give him a free ticket to Friday nights at Nolamara. Who knows? It might work. Otherwise, just find another job, you know, because of your health. Do you believe in the healing power of mantras? Do they help in meditation? Yeah, I've already heard the most powerful mantra in the whole world. You've already heard it. What is it?
Shut up.
Yes. It may not heal you, but it'll heal other people. They don't have to put up with you. But other things, now the words have power. So, now just, now, may I be happy, may I be well. Keep on repeating that to yourself. It does work. Now, like when you think, breathing in peace, breathing out sort of sickness or whatever, it works. So you can make up your own mantra as long as it resonates with you. It's got meaning for you. It sounds good. It interests you. And then you can keep on doing it and it can be healing for you. Are there any other ways to find evidence for reincarnation other than seeing your past lives through meditation? For those who haven't experienced that, thanks. Yes, there is. The best evidence for reincarnation is to die. So try that tonight. Then you'll find out for sure. I don't know if this was actually, they said this was actually true, that in somebody's suicide note, they said the reason for their suicide, I wanted to find out whether reincarnation was true or not. Apparently it was true, they actually. It sounds like a joke, but sometimes people are really weird. But yeah, seeing your past lives through meditation, you can do it through hypnotic regression, if you can't do it, and you know, you get to regress into past lives. Sometimes it's spontaneous recognition of past lives. That's quite rare, but sometimes you go to a place or a situation and it just, you remember, something triggers memories from a long time ago. I was talking to one of the members in Perth, and we're talking about this English comedian. This was a long time ago, you know, when I watched the TV. His name was Roy Hudd. He was quite well known on TV in UK, but he wasn't that well known in other parts of the world. But it was actually an interesting story. He just finished doing a show in London, and there was a new one-way system, so he got lost in his car. And he turned down a street he'd never been down before in this life. And all the memories came back to him of his previous life. Because those streets in London, you know, interior they changed, but outside they look exactly the same the last 100, 150 years. He remembered that street, that's where he used to live before. And the other interesting thing, in London, if it is someone who's reasonably well known, famous in their last life, they have these blue plaques. If you've been to London, they have all these blue plaques. You know, Sir Winston Churchill lived here, or Sir Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin here. All these famous people have these blue plaques, and there's a blue plaque on the house where he used to live. In his previous life, he was one of the very famous music hall entertainers called Dan Lena. He said, "That was me in a previous life," he said. He knocked on the door of the house, and because he was a well-known TV personality in England, the owners of the house recognized him. "Roy Hudd, what are you doing here?" He said, "I used to live here." He said, "No, we've been here for years in my previous life." And he took them all around the house. And he pointed out, he said, "There should be a door here." He said, "No, there's never been a door here." Later on, they checked in the plans. There was a door here in the previous owner's time. And his recall was absolutely perfect. He's just going down that street, just jogged the memory, and it all came back to him. And he actually wrote about that in an article. It was such a powerful experience. And because he was well known, you know, it was published. But somebody told me the other part of the story. In those days, there were two TV companies in Britain. You know, it was BBC and what they called ITV. And he did most of his work for ITV, and the head of ITV was a devout Catholic. And when he read that story, he just stopped employing Roy Hudd. It ruined his career. Because he didn't want sort of people to believe in reincarnation. And I never knew that before. That was just told me by one of these people who also knew the story. But what was fascinating there, that here was a guy in his previous life was an entertainer. And in his new life, he still had that character and that ability to entertain. You know, the character keeps on from life to life, even though it's a new life. It was a fascinating story. So sometimes you have spontaneous recall. You see someone or you go to a place and it all comes back to you. That's another way. So there's many ways which you can rediscover your past life, but those are the main three ways, through meditation. And the way through meditation, I haven't said it yet, maybe I should have really said it, you know, when I talk about jhanas. If you have a very deep meditation, very powerful, very still, very beautiful, as you come out, then you just mention the suggestion. It's a suggestion to the mind. What's my earliest memory? If it's going to work, it works immediately. A memory comes into your mind. And it's real. It's not like the memories of what you ate this morning. It's a re-experiencing of the event. You're back there. And you know, I've told this before. I don't mind saying this. It's not quite psychic powers, but it's pushing the envelope a little bit. I'm not allowed to say about an experience of my own previous lives, but what I do to give you the idea, I was doing this once years ago, and what came into my consciousness was a smell. And you know, I asked, what's my earliest memory? And I got this smell in my nose. It wasn't in the hall where I was sitting. And I recognized it immediately. It was the smell of my baby's pram when I was maybe 3 or 4 weeks old. And with that smell just came all the memory. You could actually, eyes were closed. I was back in my baby's pram with all my little toys. And the one I liked the best was Porky the Pig. That's what mother used to call it. You know, even though I'm not supposed to have a brain to remember that, I remember that. And it was a little pig. It had some like beans inside, plastic, and she used to walk it, you know, and make it rattle. And I loved that little pig, Porky the Pig. My favorite toy is a little kid. And you can actually look around, you know, feel just the blankets or the sheets and the black and whites of the pram. You could see everything. And you could actually, like, you can move, just, you know, will, what's over there, what's over here. And this is all just in a re-imagination, not re-experiencing of an old memory. You're back when you're 3 or 4 weeks old. I don't know exactly how long, but maybe around that time. And that was how it works. And no doubt at all that that's you. Very clear, being able to move around. If you want to ask a question, you know, what was my name, who was that, you can get the answer straight away. Just think and the answer comes. And that's what it's like. A re-experiencing. And of course, you know, I told that story to a few people just to check it out. And one interesting thing which I got from that, because I was never, you know, did any medicine. I was physics and maths. And I was told afterwards that in the first weeks of life, the dominant sense in a baby is smell. Now their hearing is not developed, even sight is not developed at all. And you recognize your surroundings and you recognize your mother in particular by her smell, not by her sight. So just because I'm a cheeky monk, I tell young mothers, when you've got a young kid, please do not change your perfume. Otherwise, you'll confuse the hell out of your kid. They won't know who you are. You can change your hairdo, you can dye your hair, new clothes, that doesn't matter. But the smell is what your baby recognizes. And, you know, having been there and recalled it, and, you know, with using meditation, there's no doubt that's actually what happens. You know that. That's how young babies recognize their surroundings by smells. So then you say, earlier, please. And then if the mind is strong enough, you get earlier memories. Sometimes it's amazing you get time in your mum's womb. Feel what it's like, you know, to swimming around in the liquid. Or earlier, please. But if you try this, a few people have done this. There's a little problem. It's easy to fix. Sometimes you get your previous life and the most recent part of your previous life and the most powerful is your previous death. And a few people have got that and they don't want to do it again because it's obviously painful. Now, it's not just remembering, you're back there dying. You're feeling everything. So if that ever happens to you, get your previous life and you feel that, you know, this is my death, immediately just say earlier, please, and you just move back away from the death, you know, to a much easier experience from a previous life to deal with. So if you do get painful, earlier please, your mind will go straight back. At that time when you've had some really good meditation, your mind is just, as the Buddha said, it said malleable, workable. You just tell it what to do and it does it straight away. It's perfectly obedient. And it just does it. So that's why you have to have the deep meditation first of all. If it works, it's going to work straight away. So don't say, you know, at my earlier memory please, and nothing happens, and start to force it. It works straight away or not at all. So don't waste time. So that's how you can do it. And the reason why I encourage that is because there's too many people doubt, you know, reincarnation. It's a fact. It's not a fact of life, it's a fact of death. But it's still a fact. So, and it makes a great change to the way you look at your life. You know, once you accept reincarnation, just this whole one life business, it's, you don't get so upset at things. Okay, so you lose your job. So what? You've had many jobs in many lives. So, you know, this time you get a cancer and, you know, you have bad luck or, you know, you lose a leg or something. That's just not, if this is the only life you have, that's really, really hard to bear. But, you know, if it's one life amongst many, then okay, you know, the next one will be a bit better. So, you know, it gives a big picture. If you only had one day to live, now, this day was the only one you ever had. That really sucks. You know, it's just, I wasted a whole day. That's my whole life. But if you know you can have many, 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 many days, it's not so important. You're much more at ease and at peace and much more mellow. That's why getting people to understand reincarnation or rebirth really helps. That's why I really push it. Anyway, if you don't believe in rebirth in this life, you will in your next. That's the old joke. In some Buddhist books, it is described that one is free from burning desire, has a cool mind. Could you please explain what it means by a cool mind? That has a metaphorical, literal meaning, both. Because, you know, the word that people say these days, cool. You know, I remember just going just down the street outside the hardware shop in Armidale, where we get our stuff, and these school kids came out and they looked at me and said, are you a real Buddhist monk? I said, yes. Cool. That was really good. I like that. So if you've got a cool mind, it means like a really good mind, you know, a skillful mind, an awesome mind. So it's great. So, but it's also, you become cool because, you know, all the heat which comes from so much thinking, it does actually give you a fever sometimes. You think so much. And your mind is really calm, which means it doesn't get upset. People call you a stupid pig. And you're just so cool about it. Okay, oink, 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 oink. You can have fun. So, you know, you don't get upset. I heard that story once down in Leech Highway years ago. That's one of the big roads over here. You know, it was a hot day in the summer, and it was, and I was in the passenger seat of this old bus we had with the window down to try and get some air in. And we came to a red light, and there was like, you know, two or three lanes. And so this group of young people, you know, about four or five young kids in the car, they sort of pulled up next to us. They saw we were monks, and they started cheering. You know, as young kids, you know, trying to sort of tease you. And one of them got out a magazine, and he was holding it up, saying, "Playboy." I thought that was really sort of cool thing, you know, trying to sort of, you know, upset a monk by getting Playboy. And I thought it was very funny. I just laughed, you know, just, I didn't look. But they're good kids having a laugh, so I laughed as well. So that's how you can have a cool mind, you know, but if you really get upset, and, you know, then that's actually when you don't have a cool mind. You get angry and you get really hot. You can see hot, you go red inside. So that's actually a go burning desire. Just keep it cool. Because sometimes, again, like, you know, someone chooses your, steals your favourite tea. I keep cool. There's lots more tea in Australia. They steal it, that's fine. Or they take the last piece of bread, the last piece of toast, or the last piece of whatever you want. Ah, it doesn't matter. You know, they can sort of have that. So you keep cool. You don't worry about things. No such desire. Can you talk about path and fruit seriously? That's the toughest question I've ever had, to be serious about path and fruit. I'll give a big talk on enlightenment later on in the retreat, because that's a big question, takes a lot of time. So I'll do that later on. It's a talk. It's a morning talk. Is it possible to be a part-time monk or an affiliate monk of the monastery? Yes, you can just be from Monday to Friday and you can have the weekends off. No, of course not. This is a full... Actually, that was one thing which I lost my faith a little bit in Tibetan Buddhism. I used to go to this monastery in the north of... in actually Scotland. It's called Sami Ling Monastery. It was one of the first, you know, Buddhist monasteries in that place, part of the world. And I didn't care what type of Buddhism, you know, I was following. If there's a monastery there, a place you can meditate, I would go. But when I went there, you know, the fellow in charge there, you know, he was in his robes. I asked him questions. I got really inspired. But then I found out, you know, by staying at 5 o'clock, you know, he changed into his suit and went home to his wife. And he literally was just, you know, a daytime monk. And the rest of the day. So it was the Sakya tradition. That's actually part of their tradition there. They're not real monks, they're teachers. But I thought that, hang on, you know, you're either a monk or you're not a monk. You know, you can't be sort of, you know, half and half. It didn't really make any sense to me at all. It's just like, I know sometimes, I've seen this actually, that unfortunately this is Sri Lanka mostly. They keep on the Poya days, that's, you know, the Sabbath days, they keep 13 precepts. 13 precepts on the Sabbath days. They keep 8 precepts in the morning and 5 precepts in the afternoon. That's called the 13 precepts. Because, you know, the hardest of the 8 precepts is not eating in the afternoon. So determine, okay, we won't eat in the afternoon. They determine that for the morning. When it comes to midday, then they keep the 5 precepts. So you can't do these things part-time. Is there any way to ask you questions after this retreat? Yes, come to the next retreat. If we acknowledge, okay, if we, basically, that you, there's too many of you, there's only a few monks, there's only one of me. And imagine just if every one of you had like personal access. You know, so it's not impossible, it's unfair. So during the retreat, that's enough. If we acknowledge, forgive, learn, and flush down toilet, will we still face the consequence of the naughty karma we did in the past? That is a very good question. A lot of the karma which you've done in the past, if you acknowledge, forgive, learn, and flush it down the toilet, you won't receive the consequences. Very heavy karma you might, or actually you will, but just the ordinary karma you won't. It's amazing the nature of the mind. You punish yourself because you think you ought to be punished. But once you learn about forgiveness and really learn how to let go, then you don't need to punish yourself for that karma anymore. There's not someone, you know, up there or inside or somewhere else who's got this big book about all your bad deeds and is going to punish you, and they can't sort of stop punishing you. You're the one who punishes you. You're the one who rewards you. And because of that, you realize that forgiveness can actually get rid of a lot of old karma. In part, it's called ahosi karma, karma that was. It's usually understood for the stream winner. Once a person is a stream winner, so much of the bad karma they've done in the past, which would normally send them to a rebirth in the lower realms, is no longer active. It's gone, finished, it's done with. And the reason is because being a stream winner, I'll mention this later on in the talk about the paths and fruits, means you really have understood non-self. You don't have to punish yourself. There's no one there. You can really let go and forgive. As soon as you think there's an identity, a very strong me here, then you'll always be wanting to punish yourself. That's why the stream winner doesn't go to any of those it's not as if the stream winner hasn't done any bad karma. They just can forgive, big time, and let it go. They don't collect any shit anymore, they just collect eggs. They delete all the bad photographs. You can do that. It's an amazing insight to know that. No one else can forgive you. You may pray to Jesus, pray to Allah, pray to whoever you like. You may pray to the Buddha, you may ask forgiveness of me, but you're the only one who can forgive you. Other people can actually encourage you. But in the end, one day you decide, enough. You forgive yourself and let it go. That's a beautiful time of your life. So that's actually how karma works. Ajahn, if we are having trouble with work or family and the mind is having a hard time watching the breath, what do we do? Should we stop trying to meditate, or is there any tricks to the mind to relax so we go to deep meditation? Yeah, this is actually, you know, sometimes it happens. If, you know, you can't do anapanasati, then stop doing anapanasati and instead I'll teach you breath meditation. And if that doesn't work, then I'll teach you letting go meditation. If that doesn't work, I'll teach you metta meditation. If that doesn't work, I'll teach you loving kindness meditation. And if that doesn't work, then I'll teach you anapanasati. By that time, you won't remember that that's what you couldn't do in the first place. Mate, these are all the same. If that doesn't work, I'll teach you vipassana. If that doesn't work, I'll teach you samatha. Look, all these things, they're different in name. Maybe on the outside they look different, but they're all exactly the same. They're all putting down the cup, carrying no burdens, freeing yourself, letting go. So, the advice is, if that's you who asked that question, can you make peace? Stop fighting? Can you be kind? Can you be gentle? If you can do those three things, you're meditating. Just making peace. Yeah, you've got a difficult life. Yeah, you can't meditate. But you can make peace, can't you? Stop fighting. You can always be kind. Even if you're going crazy, you can still be kind. No matter what's happening, you can always be gentle. So that's the only job you have to do in the meditation. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. And if anybody wants to know where that comes from, that is the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Samma Sankappa. Right or perfect intentions. Where you move the mind to. Nekamma Sankappa. Which is thoughts, intentions of letting go. I just call it making peace. Avayapada. Same as Metta Sankappa. Kindness. And Ahimsaka Sankappa. Gentleness. So that's actually where those words come from. I don't make those up. They're straight from the Noble Eightfold Path. Make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. And you're fulfilling one of the most important parts of the Eightfold Path. The intention, where all your actions come from. The motivation of your mind. You can always do that. Therefore, you're always practicing. And if you make peace, if you're kind, if you're gentle, the mind becomes peaceful. Kindness is there and everything is just so gentle and easy. That's how you meditate. You fight and make war. You just get what we call these days collateral damage. Headaches, pain, frustration. But if you make peace, you find peace. No matter what you're experiencing, bad bosses, headaches, pains, restless mind, sleepiness, you have peace. If you're kind, kindness is another way of saying letting go, letting things be, and be so gentle. So you can always make peace, be kind, be gentle. So you can always meditate throughout this whole retreat. Don't care what's happening, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then have a wonderful time. Do you think it is possible to be very wealthy and then get enlightened? Is wealth an obstacle? I'm very wealthy. I have this huge property over the road. And I have my own sort of resort on this side of the road. I have my townhouse in Nollamara. What is wealth? What is wealth is you want for nothing. Have you ever heard that phrase? A wealthy person, they want for nothing. So who's wealthy here? Come on, put your hands up, Bikudis. You want for nothing. I want for nothing. I'm happy as I am. So that's what real wealth is. Wanting for nothing. So this happened to me. It's one of the old stories. Over in Thailand, I'm not allowed to receive any money. But there is something which in the Vinaya is called mendicant allowance. What that means is you can come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you've really done a lot of good work for me. I want to give you a gift. Not for the monastery, not for the retreat center, not for the nuns, for you, your personal use. And you usually say, how much worth? So, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. So, $100. I've set aside $100 for you. Whatever you need for that amount of money, just let me know. The first time that happened, I was a young monk in Thailand. I'd helped somebody, given them some counseling, and they were so appreciative. They said, look, 100 baht. Now, what do you want for that? Because they knew this allowance. Now, I can't accept the money, but I can accept the goods for that amount. So they asked me, what do you want? And my mind went blank, and I said I couldn't think about what I wanted. And the donor was getting impatient. So, you know, I came up with an idea. I said, look, I know you're coming back tomorrow. Just leave it with me. This evening I will think about it, and I'll come back to you. He said, fine, it's a good idea. So that evening I went back to my room, and I started thinking, what do I need? And I was, you know, writing on just a scrap of paper. So the first thing I put down was an exercise book, some proper paper to write on. And then I put down actually a pen, you know, so I could do some writing. And I was just writing by a candle. So, you know, I wanted one of these little oil lamps so I could actually, you know, write a bit better. I'm talking about lights. My flashlight was really sort of gone. I need a new flashlight with some batteries. And then I started thinking, hang on, that's 100 baht is not enough now. And you know, I couldn't actually scratch anything off the list. In fact, I started thinking of other things. You know, writing, I needed some aerograms. I've got a mother and family over in England. I need to write to them. So I put down some aerograms. I needed some stamps. And the list got longer and longer. And once I'd written them down, they were all absolutely necessary. I didn't know how I lived without them beforehand. And that's what I thought was going on. And I immediately took that piece of paper and scrunched it up and threw it into the spittoon. And when that fellow came the next day, I said, don't you ever do that to me again. I was such a happy monk before you gave me $100 to spend. Before I wanted for nothing. Now I had 100 bucks. My desires had no end. Do you understand? So if you win the lottery, and I think somebody said at the end of the year, because the 31st of December, the Australian lottery is going to be $31 million. Do you think that will satisfy you? Every person who wins the lottery, they buy another lottery ticket next week. They always do that. It's weird, isn't it? Isn't $31 enough? No, no, the yacht's not big enough. So it's nice being a monk. You know, you don't have any money. You can't want for anything. That makes you feel very wealthy. I want for nothing. That's real wealth. And that's where you get in mind. May I ask, what is the best way to meditate when our mind is filled with anger? Is it okay with such a mantra? Breathing in, I'm angry. Breathing out, I can feel my anger. I'm letting go of my anger. So. If it's towards a person, sometimes it's difficult to think just about the anger, not the person. Thank you. So, yeah, you can do the walking meditation mantra. I will die, that's for sure. They will die tonight. They will die tonight. Now, the nice thing with anger is to welcome it. Thank you, anger, for visiting me. There is this... Well, I'm not going to finish the questions again today. Never mind. There's this wonderful meditation story. Again, you know, many of you have heard it before, but it really is worthwhile telling again. Called The Demon in the Emperor's Palace. It's a beautiful story. I've told this to psychologists, and it's one of the four stories they use all the time to help people. Once there was a monster who came to the emperor's palace while the emperor was away. And this monster was so frightening that all the guards who should stop it entering, they froze, allowing the demon to walk right through the palace. And the demon walked right into the central hall and sat on the emperor's throne. And at that, the guards, the soldiers, the ministers, they came to their senses and they said, "Get out of here! Who do you think you are? You can't sit in our emperor's throne!" And at those few unkind words, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and the language got worse. And that really upset everybody. And they started getting out their swords and making threats. But at every unkind word, unkind deed, or unkind thought, the monster just grew another inch bigger, more terrifying, more smelly, and the language got worse. And this had been going on a long time when the emperor came back. And he saw this monster, you know, almost the size of half this hall, huge, and was so ugly, so frightening, that, you know, all self-respecting monsters will be scared too, let alone human beings. And the smell coming off the monster was so bad that even the maggots crawling over him threw up, they were sick. Well, that's quite a nice bit of English, that, you know. That, I like that. I invented that one. But anyway, the language was also so bad. They just make you cringe. So, as soon as the emperor saw this, the reason he was the emperor, because he was wise. So straight away, he said to this frightening, ugly, stinky demon, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you anything to drink yet?" And with those few kind words, the monster grew an inch smaller, less frightening, less smelly, less offensive. And everybody realized their mistake. So one of them came up to him and said, "Do you like a cup of tea? We have Dilma from Sri Lanka. We have green tea. It's good for your health. Would you like milk or soya milk? We have sweetened condensed milk, just like I said. Or would you prefer some orange juice?" And somebody said, "How about a foot massage? Because those monsters had such big feet. It took about 4 or 5 people just around 1 foot. Oh, and the monster really appreciated it. Just over there. Oh, lovely. Thank you." And somebody else, "How about something to eat?" So they got him a pizza. Monster size. And Every kind word, kind deed, kind thought, that monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And it soon was back to the size when he first came in. But of course they never stopped. They laid on the kindness so much that soon the monster was so tiny, but one more kind word and the monster vanished completely away. And that is a story adapted from the Udana told by the Buddha. He called those, he said, those are called anger-eating demons. You feed them anger and they grow an inch bigger, more ugly, more of a problem. But I added the piece about the foot massage and the pizza. That is not in the original. But the gist of the story is the same. There are many anger-eating demons in the world. And in your mind as well. Sloth and torpor. Restlessness. Get out of here. You don't belong. Lustful thoughts. Whatever it is. Get out. And they just grew an inch bigger. More ugly. More of a problem. More strong. Because they are anger-eating monsters. Give them anger. They grow an inch bigger. So try giving your anger kindness. Thank you, anger. Thank you for visiting me. I'm going to look after you and care. Depression. Oh, thank you, depression. Such a long time since we met. It's only yesterday, but that's long enough. And then you find that those angry-eating demons get smaller, not a problem at all. The same with that person who speaks in your room. Who keeps on saying, I don't like this tea, I want the other type of tea. You give them anger, and they'll get louder. So give them kindness. Oh, I'll try and find that tea for you. And they'll get softer and disappear. And they're not a monster anymore. So there's many anger-eating demons, but most of them are in your head. So give them kindness. It's a brilliant story, and that works so well in your meditation. How many angry-eating demons have you met today in your meditation? Is it not good enough? I should try harder. And it gets worse. So be kind. And the demon grows smaller. Why do we tend to hold the breath when we're stressed? And is that something we should work with by meditating? You know when you're stressed, you know, it means you're trying to control. You become stressed just... We react to stress by trying to work harder and control harder and force harder. So when you get stressed, I just let go, for goodness sake. It's an anger-eating demon, stress. So just be kind. Stress, thank you. What stress is wonderful for me. It's like, you know, when I get worried. When I get worried, thank you. I'm going to lose weight now. That's one of the reasons why I'm so fat, because I've lost the ability to get anxious. People say if you worry a lot, you lose weight. But I can't do that anymore. It's really unfair. So anyway. Ajahn, as a first-time visitor, I would like to have a look around the monastery. Is this possible? Is there anything worth seeing there? Or only a load of monks looking into their toilet bowls for a bit of excitement? Yeah, you've got it in one. Just a load of monks looking into their toilet bowls for a bit of excitement. That's us. Yeah, of course you can go over there any old time you want. If you actually want to go over there, you can see my cave. That's a tourist attraction of Bodhinyana Monastery. So ask a monk and he'll take you into the cave. If done something wrong which leads to bad karma, forgiveness reverse such bad karma? Yes, it can. That's why forgiveness is really important. I already mentioned that earlier. When you read the question, could you please do it slower? And the answer is no. Okay, I'll try. Dear Ajahn, a long time ago, you once told a beautiful story of when you were in Thailand revolving around the disabled girl and her drawing. If you remember it, can you please tell it? Okay. Yeah, it's a really nice story. There was a mentally disabled girl in the local village, and she couldn't speak. She could actually just grunt. She made grunting noises. Now, the nice thing in those days that, you know, if you had any disability, you weren't put in an institution or separated from others. You were just, you know, part of the village. So even though she couldn't speak, she went to every party, every engagement, every sort of ceremony, you know, with her friends. And the weird thing for me, which was really strange, was her friends could understand what those grunts meant. It was like another language. Now I knew Thai and Lao. And I asked these girls, well, how do you understand what she's talking? See, we understand everything. That particular grunt means this. Another tone of grunt means something else. Because they'd grown up with her. They were her friends. So even though she was mentally disabled, couldn't speak, you know, she was emotionally so secure. She had all her friends. She was part of the village. And it's actually wonderful to see. They weren't segregated. They were just loved. And I thought, you know, how wonderful that would be if we didn't have institutions, if, you know, whenever you went out to sort of to a party or to dinner, you know, you went out with everybody, you know, even disabled people, and they felt part of things, and you could understand them. So anyway, I was cleaning the hall one day at the monastery, and I saw this disabled girl sneak in. She didn't see me. I was up behind a cupboard. And, you know, she looked around as if she was going to steal something. That's what she reminded me of, a burglar. But I thought, this girl wouldn't do that. So I just watched what she did. You know, I was just watching without her seeing me. And she's made sure that no one was there. She didn't see me. She went up to the shrine and she put something on the shrine in front of the Buddha, then ran out. And I wanted to find out what it was. And it was like a folded piece of paper made into a lotus flower. It was her gift, you know, to the Buddha. And she'd looked around because it wasn't all that beautiful, because, you know, she didn't have much ability. She'd done the best she possibly could, and that was her gift. And she was looking around because she was embarrassed. And she thought if somebody saw her, then maybe they wouldn't be allowed. And so when I saw that, you know, I went wet-eyed. There was a lady who, you know, could do very little but do that, and that was her little gift. And so when I told the monks that evening what had happened, I said, look, that lotus stays on that shrine. And if any of you move it, you know, I'm going to be an angry Ajahn Brahm. And it's such a beautiful gift. It's one of the greatest gifts of charity I've ever seen. I've seen other people write out checks for $250,000 and stuff like that. But that's not like a disabled girl doing something as best she could and putting it on the shrine. Now, to this day, it makes me feel sort of emotional. A beautiful gift. That's the best she could do, and it's wonderful. And she shouldn't have felt embarrassed. She's most welcome to that any old time. Anyway, that's the story of the disabled girl. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if we keep our 10-second silence after confrontation, some people take an arm when given a finger. When do we stop, if ever? Okay, remember, it's nothing to do with you, that 10-second silence when a person's getting angry at you. It gives them the opportunity to see what they've just said, to reflect on themselves. Because when they get angry, you're getting angry at him or her. You're not looking at yourself, you're looking at the object of your anger. You never realize what it's doing to yourself. So 10 seconds of silence is giving a person the opportunity to understand what they've just done. A lot of times, that really solves the situation. You're giving a person a chance to be mindful of the effects of bad speech. They feel terrible. It doesn't always work. It doesn't work with everybody, but it's worth a try. And it worked with many, many people. And they realized that getting angry and shouting at people is a very uncomfortable, uncivilized, nasty thing to do. And you feel that nastiness. You feel terrible afterwards. So it's a nice thing to experiment with. What is my motivation to come to retreat, after facing the same sloth and torpor, chatting mind, etc.? Not once experienced any deep meditation. I don't quite understand myself. Am I being programmed? Yes, you are being programmed. So you have to come to the next retreat no matter what. Now, after a while, it's sometimes that people come to retreat after retreat after retreat. What they're doing is like people buying lottery ticket after lottery ticket after lottery ticket. One day they win. If you don't buy any lottery tickets, you can never win. So one day you come to a retreat and you press the right button and you do get the deep meditation. That's why it's worthwhile coming. Is there any teaching from the Buddha called the Lotus Sutta? If does, do you please explain the main subject of it? No, actually the Lotus Sutta was not from the Buddha. It came about, I think, 200 or 300 years afterwards was the time when the Lotus Sutta was actually written down. If you don't believe me, look at the evidence. Very good. I've been to a retreat in Burma. I saw a couple of retreatants whilst in a sitting position, spinning their bodies, the upper part of the bodies. What was that? Does it happen only with Vipassana method or to any others? Spinning their bodies. Correct? Was their bottoms actually stable and just the tops were spinning? I don't know. It's really, really weird. Anyway, I never seen that. I know that sometimes people shake or whatever, or they move around. Sometimes, again, that's a lot of energy staying in the body when it should be going into the mind. So it does really weird things. But no, I haven't seen that, so I don't know what they're doing. Does the stupa have any meaning? Yeah, actually, that stupa, that's from Borobudur. It's actually from the same stone, and that was offered to us when we started this retreat center. They have a Buddha statue inside, and the meaning, this is what I was told in Java when I went there. You climb to the top of the big stupa, and have all these Buddhas in these, the same type of stone with little holes in. And they say that if you can reach inside and touch the Buddha, then you will find true love. And if I see any of you, especially the nuns, doing that... Vikuni Satima. No, no. Oops. you're too old for true love. Like most of you. So actually, that's what they said. But all it is just the stupa. It's a nice Buddhist monument. The real stupas are usually things which... Stupa just means a mound. And it's just what contains usually the relics, the ashes of... famous arahats or Buddhas. So that's what they really are. Okay. This is the joke. And I'm going to read this out. It's a bad joke, but it's not my joke. What is white, transparent, and sits on a meditation cushion? A Buddhist monk with a ship flushed out of him. Hee 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 hee. What is white, transparent, and sits on a meditation cushion? That's original, anyway. Can you explain the practice of the medicine Buddhas? Does this lead to healing? That's a Tibetan. I don't really know that at all, so I can't really comment on that one. That's the Vajrayana teaching. Could you please take us to Bodhinyana Monastery tomorrow? No, take yourself. Is it possible to go mad when you get into a steep taste of meditation? No. No, it is not. You don't go mad in deep states of meditation. You go mad because you don't meditate. Do women find it harder than men to meditate? How would you know? I'm a man. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. And you women don't know what it's like to be a man. So who knows? Who cares? Are there more... Actually, no, this is... Are they more identified or attached to their ego and life context than men? Actually, this is what I've actually found through experience, that it's usually women have an easier time getting into jhanas than men do. This is just, you know, anecdotal through experience. But the men seem to catch up. They can understand and make sense of it more. They sort of have an easier time with the insight. So in other words, the women get into jhana quicker, but the men catch up. Once they get into jhana, they get sort of the understanding much quicker. So in the end, it's nice and even. Isn't that nice? That's just what I found. And I think it's mostly because the deep meditations are feely-feely states. You have to have like an emotional sensitivity. Because in a deep meditation, you're not thinking your way through. You're feeling your way into deep meditation. Feeling the emotions, being at ease with the bliss, being able to understand it, accept it, leave it alone. And for some men, they're just, you know, strong emotions like bliss or like crying during meditation. They're not used to that. They think there's something wrong. They tend to control or resist too much. So just let the emotions come, especially in meditation. If you feel like bursting into tears and crying, go for it. That's the type of pity which comes up in meditation. It's a good sign. So sometimes the men need to just to be able to accept the powerful emotions which come from deep meditation. Incredible pity and joy and inspiration. You do feel like crying. The first time I got a deep meditation, I really felt like going to the teacher and just kissing his feet all over. That's incredible emotions of gratitude and joy and stuff like that. And so you've got to get used to those. So by resisting them, you stop the progress. Can you please warn the monks and nuns against creating an ego out of being a renunciant? I see that happens sometimes, unfortunately. Since the nuns community is an early delicate stage of development, they should be careful to falling into the I am a bhikkhuni trap and try to keep the path of renunciation clearly in mind. Monks too. You've really got great bhikkhunis here. And look, a lot of the times, especially when you come to the West, you're not really given much much respect. In your monastery you are, but you go out the street and people shout at you, they show you copies of Playboy magazine. And they ask, why didn't you get a proper job? That's what someone, this is just things which someone's thrown stones at me once, and someone has, they look me up and down and say, you're dressed like a girl, you're sick. So, that soon brings you down to earth. The real problem is in places like Thailand or even in Sri Lanka. I'm not sure about Burma, never been to Burma. Those are the real danger places, because there any mug is respected. And no one will ever criticize you no matter what you do. So coming to the West, you really have to earn your respect. It's not given to you automatically just because you're a monk. And, you go to some of the great places I send the monks is to prisons. And when you go inside a prison, the first prison I went to as a monk, the prisoners, this was in Fremantle Jail years ago. That's closed down now. The guy who was receiving me said, look, don't give us any bullshit in here. You speak honestly, we'll respect you. You try and put on airs and graces, and then, we're not listening. And I really respected that. They just wanted just to be a person to be honest. And then they gave you real respect. But if you were faking it and just trying to live up to some ideal, then they wouldn't have any bar of you. And that's why I really enjoyed going to prisons. It was strange. It was an honest environment. Sometimes that people just play around here. They try and ask some nice questions. They try and sit. They're just trying to live up to some ideal. But in prisons, all that's been stripped away of them. The ego has been so removed when they get into those jails. There's a sense of honesty there. It's interesting. But don't create an ego. That's why it's great to do labouring work as Ajahn Brahm, the senior monk. Sometimes it's great, again, being with the Sangha, they keep me in line. So you go over to sort of Penang and people ask you for autographs. You go to Sri Lanka and you go on TV. You come to Australia and the customs takes you apart and sort of say, what are you doing? Where are the drugs? You don't get any respect at all, which is great. Dear Ajahn, thank you for showing me the path. When Piti Sukha comes up and I get a bit excited and do nothing, when Piti Sukha comes up, I get a bit excited, and doing nothing is doing something. What is safe to focus on? The sustained breath? Sometimes what you're saying here is a difficulty of actually doing nothing. So it's actually not doing nothing, it's nothing doing. So, you look at this doer and you just stop it. So sometimes little similes are good, like the simile of the still forest pool. It's a brilliant one. Or the simile of you're driving in your car, take the hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, hand off the gear stick, no more controlling. That simile helps me. I can understand, driving my meditation, I'm going to stop, take the hand off everything. And that's letting go. Letting go of control. Now, if you understand what that is, it's not a doing at all. It's a total letting go. If you try to do letting go, it's not happening at all. It's letting go of doing. So, with that, I am now going to let you go to bed. And these ones over here are, if there's good karma, they'll be answered tomorrow. If not, they won't. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. It's 9:20, and it's way past your bedtime. So please have a nice night's sleep. And I'll see you in the morning, if the karmic conditions are right. If not, I'll be reincarnated.